The remaining adjective that characterizes Greenland Norse society is Eurocentric. From Europe, the Greenlanders received material trade goods, but even more important were non-material imports, identity as Christians and as Europeans. Let us consider first the material trade. What trade items were imported into Greenland, and with what exports did the Greenlanders pay for those imports? For medieval sailing ships, the voyage to Greenland from Norway took a week or more and was dangerous. Hence, the Greenlanders were visited by at most a couple of ships a year, and sometimes only one every few years. In addition, the capacities of European cargo ships were small. Estimates work out to about 7 pounds of cargo per person per year, on the average. Most Greenlanders receive much less than that average, because much of that arriving cargo capacity was devoted to materials for churches and luxuries for the elite. Hence, imports could only be valuable items occupying little space. Our two sources of information about Greenland's imports are lists in Norwegian records and items of European origin found in Greenland archaeological sites. They included especially three necessities: iron that the Greenlanders were hard-pressed to produce for themselves, good lumber for buildings and furniture, and tar as a lubricant and wood preservative. As for non-economic imports, many were for the church, including church bells, stained glass windows, bronze candlesticks, communion wine, linen, silk, silver, and churchmen's robes and jewelry. Among secular luxuries found in archaeological sites at farmhouses were pewter, pottery, and glass beads and buttons. Small-volume luxury food imports probably included honey to ferment into mead, plus salt as a preservative. In exchange for those imports, the same consideration of limited ship cargo capacity would have prevented Greenlanders from exporting bulk fish, as did medieval Iceland, even if Greenlanders had been willing to fish. Instead, Greenland's exports, too, had to be things of low volume and high value. They included skins of goats, cattle, and seals, of which medieval Europe required large quantities to make leather clothes, shoes, and belts. Like Iceland, Greenland exported wool cloth that was valued for being water repellent, but Greenland's most prized exports were five products derived from Arctic animals: ivory from walrus tusks, walrus hide, valued because it yielded the strongest rope for ships, live polar bears or their hides as a spectacular status symbol, tusks of the narwhal, a small whale, known then in Europe as unicorn horns, and live gerfalcons, the world's largest falcon. Walrus tusks became the only ivory available in medieval Europe for carving, after Muslims gained control of the Mediterranean, thereby cutting off supplies of elephant ivory. Walruses and polar bears were virtually confined to latitudes far to the north of the two Norse settlements, in an area called the Nordsetta, the northern hunting ground, which began several hundred miles beyond western settlement. Hence, each summer, the Greenlanders sent out hunting parties in small, open, six-oared rowboats with sails, which hold up to a ton and a half of cargo. Hunters set off in June after the peak of the harp seal hunt and returned at the end of August. In such small boats, they obviously could not carry the carcasses of hundreds of walruses and polar bears. Instead, the animals were butchered on the spot, and only the walrus jaws with the tusks and the bear skins with the paws, plus the occasional live captive bear, were brought home. Also brought home was the baculum of male walruses, a bone about 1 foot long that forms the core of the walrus penis, because it proved to be of just the right size and shape to make into an axe handle or a hook. The Nordsetta hunt was dangerous and expensive in many ways. To begin with, imagine yourself equipped with just a lance, bow and arrow, or club, trying to kill a huge enraged walrus or bear before it could kill you. Please also imagine spending several weeks in a small rowboat shared with a live, trussed-up polar bear. The boat journey itself along the cold, stormy coast of West Greenland exposed hunters to risk of death from shipwreck or exposure. Apart from those dangers, the trip constituted expensive use of boats, manpower, and summertime for people short of all three. Much of what the Greenlanders obtained in return for those walrus tusks and bearskins was just luxury goods for churches and chiefs. From our perspective today, we can't help thinking of more important uses that the Greenlanders could have made of those boats and man time. From the Greenlanders' perspective, though, the hunt must have brought great prestige to the individual hunters, and it maintained for the whole society the psychologically vital contact with Europe. By the mid-1200s, there were often periods of several years in which no ship at all visited Greenland. In 1257, Norway's king Håkon Håkonsson, as part of his effort to assert his authority over all of the Norse Atlantic island societies, sent three commissioners to Greenland to persuade the hitherto independent Greenlanders to acknowledge his sovereignty and pay tribute. Although the details of the resulting agreement have not been preserved, some documents suggest that Greenland's acceptance of Norwegian sovereignty was in return for the king's promise to dispatch two ships each year. Thereafter, Greenland's trade became a Norwegian royal monopoly.